Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a Valley pastor reflects on the life and death of Charlie Kirk. And Tucson broadcasting legend Bill Buckmaster is hanging up the mic. We'll hear from him a bit later on. But first, there are a number of questions facing state lawmakers and the governor as they think about a budget for the fiscal year that starts in July. Among them, the impact of changes to some social safety net programs, including SNAP, and whether to incorporate federal changes like no taxes on tips into state law. All of that would impact the amount of money the state has to spend and on what. There are also questions about Arizona's economy overall as we enter the new year. Earlier, I talked about this with George Hammond, research professor in the Economic and Business Research Center in the Eller College of Management at the University of Arizona. And we started with what comes to mind for him when he looks at what the state's economy might look like in 2026.
Well, I think we will see somewhat better growth in Arizona in 2026 than we have over the past couple of years. Arizona's growth has been unusually slow, starting in 2024, and that has continued into 2025. I think what happened was in 2024, we ran out of momentum recovering from the pandemic, and we kind of hit a little period of doldrums. As we've gotten into 2025, though, there are different factors at play, and most of these factors originate from economic policies coming out of Washington, principally the uncertainty about federal economic policies combined with the impact of tariffs and, deportations, reduced international migration. All three of those factors are, let's say, not conducive to rapid growth. And I think that's really weighed on economic performance both nationally and here in Arizona.
Why do you think that 2026 will be the year to see that improvement?
Well, I'm hopeful that we will see less federal economic policy uncertainty going forward. I think we will see the national economy speed up a bit as things become a bit more certain. Businesses can deal with pretty much any economic policy, as long as they have some certainty and comfort with what that policy is. So, I think that as businesses see a more certain policy environment, or at least a more stable policy environment, that they'll be more comfortable both hiring and investing in new plant and equipment going forward.
Regardless of what those policies are, regardless of what the certainty ends up being, you're saying as long as businesses sort of and others in the economy sort of know what to expect, things will get better?
Yes, that's very helpful. So knowing what the economic policies will be going forward is very helpful in terms of giving businesses a comfort level in terms of pursuing both hiring and spending. And, the same is true for households, individuals in their spending, particularly those big ticket spending items like cars and houses. Knowing what the tax and overall economic policy will be gives people a level of certainty to move forward with those big decisions.
Well, so along those lines, there have been some surveys recently that show that people don't really seem to feel all that good about the economy, regardless of what the economy actually is or is doing. People don't really feel like it's going well. How much might that impact what actually happens specifically here in Arizona?
Well, the vibes do matter a bit. But, what people say they feel sometimes differ from how they really feel. That's reflected in their actions. Overall, the kind of job growth that we're seeing has so far been pretty reflective of what people are saying they feel. I'm hoping that will improve a little bit as we go through the next year.
One of the things on the state level that's been generating a lot of controversy and conversation right now is what is usually a pretty nondescript issue of tax conformity. This year, though, it potentially involves all sorts of elements from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, including doing away with taxes on tips and overtime and things like that. And if the state were to go full in, the economists are saying it's going to cost the state a lot of money, a lot less revenue coming in. I'm wondering how you see the debate on that, not asking you to get into the politics of it, but just from an economics perspective. You talk about uncertainty. Like, what does that debate and that conversation look like? And what does it maybe mean for what the state's finances could look like?
Well, you know, I think having economic policy certainty matters at the state level as well. The overall state finances are significantly impacted. That creates more uncertainty in terms of the level and type of services that the state will be able to deliver. So, you know, there are certainly elements here that can arise at the state level, but, you know, at least in my opinion, the big dog and the big source of uncertainty is what's the federal policies that are coming out of Washington. And that's where we really need to see the certainty come from.
Do you consider the future of the Affordable Care Act and how people pay for health care and get health care to be one of those elements of uncertainty, maybe even especially in a place like Arizona where health care is such a big sector in the economy?
Sure. You know, health care is a big sector of every economy nowadays. And in Arizona, as it has been nationally, that's been the major source of job growth, both in 2024 and in 2025. You know, I think given the demographics of the state and the nation and, you know, frankly, the world, where we're with the aging of the baby boom generation, you know, healthcare is going to be a sector that will continue to grow. You know, the demand will be there. The big questions are how will we pay for that? And, you know, that stuff that will matter going forward. You know, we make some assumptions about that for the model. That, you know, Medicaid spending slows, but it still remains a significant part of the overall economy. And we think that, you know, healthcare jobs are going to continue to grow just because the demand is going to be there as the baby boom generation ages.
There's been some conversation at the state capitol going into the 2026 session about, you know, this might have to be a lean budget. There's not going to be a lot of money for new programs. When you look at what the budget might look like, again, not looking at the political aspect of it, just like the numbers here, what do you see in terms of will there be money to try some new things? Will it be just sort of a status quo budget? Like, what do you see for 2026?
You know, overall, I see economic growth in 2026 as, you know, a little bit better than we've seen over the past couple of years. You know, that can differ a bit across the state revenues, but the, you know, kind of the economic performance, I think, will be slightly better. But, you know, overall, Arizona is headed for economic growth over the next decade and the next 20 and 30 years that's significantly slower than what we've seen in prior decades. And again, that's, you know, demographics driving that. And those demographics are going to impact not over, you know, overall economic growth, like job growth and income growth, but that will have a, you know, a similar impact on overall state government revenues.
Any sectors about which you are kind of concerned in 2026? Any that you think might be losing jobs or losing market share?
Well, manufacturing is a sector that we continue to watch. It remains weak. It has been losing jobs despite all of the press that's gone towards the semiconductor sector relocating here and growing here. I do think we will eventually see growth in the semiconductor sector that contributes to overall gains in manufacturing, but we're definitely not there yet. And the tariffs, you know, in the short run are not conducive to growth in the manufacturing sector either, at least in the short run.
All right. That is George Hammond, a research professor in the Economic and Business Research Center in the Eller College of Management at the University of Arizona. George, thanks as always. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
As the year comes to a close, we're bringing you some of our favorite conversations of 2025. Not long ago, MAHA influencer Alex Clark made headlines for a speech at Turning Point USA's Young Women's Leadership Conference called The Four Lies of Modern Feminism. Particularly notable was the line, less Prozac, more protein. Turns out Clark lives here in the Valley, so we invited her to our studios earlier this year to speak with my co-host Sam Dingman. They began by talking about the importance of making friends with the other side of the political spectrum.
I just think it comes from getting to know the heart of people first, right? I think we have a lot more in common than we are led to believe with people that vote differently.
Well, in the spirit of getting to know your background, I have read that a big part of your awakening towards food issues in particular happened during the pandemic.
Yeah. So there were so many things that were really disturbing to me. One of them was the food supply chain crisis that we were experiencing, you know, grocery stores running out of items, running out of food. And I thought, well, I have no idea where I would go to get these things if, you know, Walmart or Whole Foods runs out. And that's a problem for a myriad of reasons. That's a problem. Knowing where your food is coming from, what those animals are eating, how those animals are treated, this is one of those issues where somebody who's very been, you know, a classical liberal their whole life and really mindful about environment or local food and organic and non-GMO and all of that, I'm like, we have a lot more in common than you think.
Well, that's one of the reasons I wanted to ask you about this, because if I'm not mistaken, you have been conservative for a long time, right? You voted for President Trump all three times that
Correct.
He ran. What was it like for you to find yourself interested in causes that had historically, quote unquote, lived on the political left?
I love going through different things in life that really challenge you and your belief system and your entire worldview and make you stop and think, wow, there's so much I don't know. Mm-hmm. And that's how it felt when I was learning about corruption in the food industry in America and corruption in the pharmaceutical industry. And the biggest thing during the pandemic was mandating the vaccine. So for me, I was super disturbed that, you know, Americans were largely being told you have to inject something into your body. If you do not do this, you may not be able to participate publicly in certain spaces. During the pandemic, because I couldn't prove my vaccination status in New York City, I was on top of the public hotel at a rooftop bar and I was kicked out. And I thought, this is evil. There's something really not right about this. And it kind of led me down this rabbit hole to learning about OxyContin and the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma. You know, that's how we got the opioid epidemic, was because of greed and people wanting to push a product that they knew was harming people. And despite that, they said, I don't care. I'm getting so rich. So I was terrified that we were going to see the same thing with the COVID vaccine. I thought, I have to talk to my audience about this. And the data, the analytics in my show is exploding whenever I cover these topics. Because
so let me make sure I understand. As your organic interests in this subject are pivoting more towards these conversations, you start to notice that your audience is getting more and more engaged, more and more excited.
And these are young conservative voters. And I said, there's something important here. This is information that this demographic has never heard. I said, if we keep talking about this, we will win the 2024 election.
So clearly, President Trump did win the election. What have you made of Secretary Kennedy's actions and the broader work that the administration has done so far around the issues that you care about?
What I love is we have changed the American food system forever with some of the moves that we've made, getting food dyes out of, you know, ultra-processed food, banning food dyes. Different states getting fluoride out of their tap water is huge. Another thing that I'm not crazy about, and this isn't really Trump, it's actually congressional Republicans, are flirting with the idea of giving full immunity to pesticide companies. And so this is a huge problem for me. This is completely anti-MAHA. The Republicans in Congress that are flirting with this idea need to know that we've got midterms coming up and you are potentially rocking the boat of a lot of MAHA voters that we need, you know, talking from a conservative standpoint, that we need to keep happy.
Can I ask, are you concerned at all about collateral damage? Because if the aim is health, right, like mm-hmm. making people more healthy, there are a lot of people who are concerned about what Secretary Kennedy has done and that the administration has done in terms of like taking research funds away from mRNA vaccines, cutting Medicaid, not doing some of the things President Trump said he was going to do around IVF. these are things that for some populations will result in more death, more health problems. Do you ever worry that the health aims around some of the issues you were just mentioning don't align with those concerns?
So let's talk about the IVF thing, because this, I'm really passionate about this. Mm-hmm. I was very happy that President Trump reversed course on asking insurance companies in America to fund IVF. And let me explain why.
Sure.
This would have been a disaster for the already looming fertility crisis that we are experiencing. There's clearly something wrong. By asking insurance companies to completely fund and pay for IVF, we are not getting to the root cause of what is contributing to these infertility problems.
Well, this is something you talk about a lot on your show, this idea of root causes. You know, when it comes to things like cancer, like you have concerns that food additives and agricultural chemicals are leading to the development of cancers and stuff like that. And I think a lot of people would agree that figuring out the root causes of these things is an inherently good thing. I wonder what you make, though, of the likelihood of casualties in the meantime. If research money and federal attention is pivoted away from things like vaccines for these illnesses, from abortion care, from Medicaid, there's going to be a lot of people who suffer in the meantime because that work isn't being funded anymore.
Well, to my knowledge, we're getting out corrupt funding. I mean, you have people funding studies and things like that for these different industries. For example, like the pharmaceutical industry can fund studies for their own vaccine. I mean, that's the type of like revolving door corruption that we have going on. So I think what Bobby Kennedy is trying to do with HHS is get in there and say, we want non-biased studies on vaccines. I think it's odd for somebody to be against that. The problem is that it's almost impossible for American parents to get information. If you go to your pediatrician and say, can you tell me every ingredient? The pediatrician should know. The pediatrician should know if they're injecting your child with something, every ingredient that is listed on there, right? But I guarantee if you go to them and you say, can you tell me offhand every ingredient in this? They would say, I don't know. I couldn't tell you that. I'm so sorry. That's an issue.
So we're talking about parenting now, which seems like a natural segue to you got a lot of press recently for speaking at the Young Women's Leadership Conference. And one of the things that you were talking about in your speech was women and careerism. That's something you have strong feelings about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just goes to like your family should be your priority. So I'm not against women working. I obviously work. So
sure.
I work. But when we're talking about lies that feminism has sold women, one of those things is you will never feel as fulfilled as you will with a career. Your family is not going to be enough. Having children is not going to be enough.
Is that messaging that you feel like you received when you were younger?
Oh, yeah. I think especially millennials as a generation, this was the message. This mm-hmm. is like girl bossism, feminism to millennials is it's career first. It's where are you going to college? What career path do you want to have? Instead, how we should be talking to women about career choices and family should start at a younger age. It should start in the teen years, in my opinion. And the conversation should look like this. Would you like to go to college? Would you like to have a career? If she says, yes, I want to have a career, then it's like, okay, amazing. You are statistically likely to, once you have kids, want to stay home with them as a woman biologically. So if you want to be a working mom, again, there's nothing wrong with that. But it's having those unpolitically correct conversations of what kind of mom do you want to be?
Sure. But what do you feel is not politically correct about what you were just articulating, this idea of, because what I heard you just saying is like that a conversation you would like to see being had with young women is you have choices.
I think culturally, this idea to even put in a woman's brain that you are statistically likely to want to quit your job once you have children, that you are statistically likely to want to at least go part-time, that you may not always want to be climbing the career ladder, just to like put that in her brain at all or kind of say that truth is seen as, again, anti-feminist. Why don't we have those types of conversations with men? And my response to that is because men and women are different. We are different. This is why it's so important to talk about the fact and the reality that there's only two genders. biologically, we do things differently. We're going to relate to our kids differently.
But I wonder, Alex, if it's not this idea of like there are two genders, there's something essential about men, there's something essential about women, and these things are just fundamentally true. I wonder if that's not where your side of this might start to lose people who you're looking to appeal to. Because I think there are a lot of people who weren't raised thinking about gender in a binary way, weren't raised thinking about these things in that way. And when you describe it like those things are absolute, I think that might make it difficult for some folks to come over to the other points that you're making.
When I say that gender is absolute?
Yeah.
I just think that's a biological fact. So, like, I'm operating in reality. So if we don't agree – if somebody is like, well, it's hard for me to support Maha because I don't believe that there's only two genders, I'm like, well, I mean, I can't help you.
But let me just ask. I mean, if there's a trans person, say,
right,
who is listening to that and hears you say something that to their ears is rejecting of their lived experience, even if they might agree with you about – the problem of additives in food. Maybe if they might agree with you about corporate capture of food systems, it seems like saying something that denies their humanity would prevent them from getting on your side of this issue that you have said, quote, every single political conversation we care about starts with food. This is like the prime directive for you as I understand it. Why say things that might exclude people who would otherwise potentially be inclined to get on board with your crusade?
Okay, there's a few things that I could say. But I would say, like, when we're speaking to people's humanity, I mean, we're all eating food, right? We're all living here. We're all breathing this air. So I would say that's whether you agree on there being two or 200 genders, we're all eating this food, we're all breathing this air, are we not? So I would say you have a vested interest in wanting to improve that.
But
also if you're trans, you're injecting yourself with chemicals likely, so I don't think you care.
Not all trans people medically transition.
Well, right. But I'm saying, though, if they were, though, I don't know why you would say, like, I care about the chemicals in food, but not this. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you really – we all have to eat to survive. So it's a vested interest. It is it's a nonpartisan issue to do something about this. And then the other stuff, you know, you've got four – we have 4 years. We have 4 years to fix the food. If you hate Donald Trump, you hate everything else that I believe – but you do agree on food and pharma, then I'd say hold your nose and vote red, because after that, who knows who we're going to have in office and if they're going to carry the torch of Maha.
We'll return with more of this conversation with Alex Clark after the break. You are listening to The Show. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, Bill Buckmaster has done about 8,000 interviews over the course of his career.
Another great one was talking with Jimmy Carter when he got off a plane in Las Vegas, and he's this former governor from Georgia, and he says, I'm going to be president someday. And I'm going, you are? He's carrying his own suit, you know, in a garment bag, and he says, I'm going to be the president. You see, you watch. Okay, yeah.
We'll catch up with longtime Tucson TV and talk radio host Bill Buckmaster before he signs off for the last time. But first, let's return to one of our favorite conversations of 2025 with Maha influencer Alex Clark. She's a big supporter of HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s policies, and there were reports during last year's presidential campaign that RFK Jr. reached out to then-Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign before ultimately endorsing President Trump. So my co-host Sam Dingman asked Clark if she, in a hypothetical scenario, would have supported Harris if Kennedy had endorsed her instead.
No, because she's one of the most funded by pharma candidates that we've ever had. So if she were to have made that statement, I would have felt like there's no way that she's telling the truth. She's not going to be able to get this done. Like, that would have just been talk.
Speaking of walking the walk, I have to ask you, you have talked about how you are not currently married and don't currently have kids, right? I want to make sure I'm not mischaracterizing.
Yes.
That. Okay. Do you have any concerns, I guess, about when you go on stage in front of a room full of women at the National Women's Leadership Conference and you are talking about the values of a life, being married, having kids, that you yourself are not currently living, but you are a person of great prominence. You're extraordinarily successful. Do you worry about sending mixed messages there?
No, because I'm very open with my audience and those women about how if, you know, I was told tomorrow, like, hey, you can be married and have kids or you can have this incredible career, I would pick family. So that's always been my number one choice. I mean, since I was 18 years old. I mean, at 19, I was like praying over my future husband, like, who is he? When am I going to meet him? I mean, this has always been like the biggest desire of my heart. So it's not that I have purposely put it off by any means. It just hasn't happened yet. This is, you know, this hasn't been my personal timing, but it's clearly God's timing. And maybe, you know, God's will is that it's I'm never going to get married and have kids. And if, you know, that makes me sad to think about, but if that were the case, then I guess, you know, my ministry or what I'm meant to do is kind of talk to these experts, get this information so that the next this generation of moms raising the next generation of kids has better information, better advice on how to raise a healthier next generation, and that's physically, emotionally, and spiritually, all those different facets of health.
Well, in that vein, I wonder if I could ask you about something that I've heard you mention in passing, and if this is not something you're comfortable talking about, I completely understand. But you talked on one of your episodes about your dad getting brain cancer, and I'm really curious when that happened in your life and how much, if at all, that informs your point of view on health issues.
Sure. Great question. So I found out that my dad at 56 was diagnosed with glioblastoma brain tumor in January of 2024. And we were told that he would have probably 18 months to live. Not only was he battling brain cancer, but he also had serious heart issues. He really needed a heart transplant. His heart was completely shutting down. He had had multiple heart attacks and heart disease. He also was a type 2 diabetic. Most of my childhood, my dad was obese. And my dad was addicted to ultra-processed food. He lived off ultra-processed food. We did not pass a White Castle or a Crystal or a Wendy's without stopping. And even when we removed the brain tumor, my dad on the way home said, can we please stop at Chick-fil-A? And then once we got home, it was, can we please go to Pizza Hut? It was never ending. I mean, the ultra processed food addiction, what people need to understand, like you're never satiated so that you eat more and then you have to buy more. It's really evil. And that happened to my dad 100%. And so we thought he had about 18 months and he ended up passing away in 11 months. So he passed away in December of 2024.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. And so he was only 57. And it absolutely put a fire under me that even doing what I do, hosting Culture Apothecary, which is one of the top 10 biggest health and wellness podcasts in the world, he did not care. He didn't want to change. He wasn't interested in you know, listening to these people or what I had to say. It was like he was just resolved to die. And so because I couldn't save my own dad, I'm like, I want to save America. I want to save the next generation of children.
Thank you for sharing that. Last question for you. You mentioned the fact that President Trump only has 4 years to make progress on these issues that you care about. Looking ahead, do you see somebody else in the political firmament who you think is likely to take up the cause? And for you personally, does that person need to be a conservative?
Great question. Okay, so as far as people who I see taking up the torch, number one, Cory Booker, a Democrat senator from New Jersey, has always been very passionate about these issues with food and pharma. This matters to him, but he's obviously incapable of winning a presidential election. So I don't know that he's going to be able to take this very far to the top. J.D. Vance, our vice president currently, I know that he cares a lot about seed oils. That is the only thing I've ever heard him talk about in regards to MAHA. I don't know what his views are on anything else. So maybe. And then everyone else, it's really fair game. I guess I would say as far as voting for a Democrat, I just these issues that MAHA cares about, it's so weird because GMOs and things were issues of Democrats. You know, talking about legalizing raw milk was issues of Democrats. This is Hollywood. Liberal celebrities cared about these things. So it's never been conservatives. And my concern is that the Democrat Party as an institution is so embedded with pharma that I don't know how they could carry on the torch of MAHA. Now, the Republican Party historically also was in bed with pharma in the exact same way. We've never had a candidate on either side that's been able to get out from underneath the grips of the pharmaceutical industry in America.
But does it concern you? I've done a couple of stories with the local MAHA chapter here in Phoenix, and a number of the folks I spoke to in connection with those stories said to me, you know, I was a Bernie person. Like, Bernie was my guy in 2016 and even in 2020. But when I saw the way he was treated by the Democratic Party and once Bobby came along, I decided to go with Bobby. And then since Bobby went with Trump, I went with Trump, which suggests to me that were another sufficiently compelling populist, left-leaning like Bernie Sanders to come along, some number of the folks who aren't currently aligned with the MAHA movement might go in that direction.
100%.
Is that something you think about, worry about?
I mean, that's just – that speaks to the – for me as a conservative, I am telling the GOP this has to matter to you because this block of voters, they are – technically politically homeless. They're not completely sold to the Republican Party. And honestly, if I was somebody who was giving my two cents to the Democrats and the future of that party, I would be saying, if you're smart, you will do that. Because that's really, I think that's going to be the biggest life vest that they could put on. Nothing is working. Nothing is popular with voters. Nothing is resonating. So you have to say, okay, what is resonating? And, you know, the things that are resonating with Republican voters, 99% of it, obviously, is not going to work for the Democrats. But the one thing we have is MAHA. So the GOP and the Democrats, it's up for grabs.
I know I said that was the last question. I have one last question for you, if you don't mind.
Okay.
You know, it was recently reported that all these millions of dollars were going to be spent to find a quote-unquote Joe Rogan of the left. It's not really clear to me what that means. But if there are people on the left who are listening to this and look to somebody like you who has created a successful media empire, has figured out a way to really connect with your base. What do you think people should be focusing on?
Curiosity. So when you talk about how the left needs to find their own Joe Rogan, what's Joe Rogan doing? Joe Rogan is curious. Joe Rogan was a Bernie supporter who voted for Trump. Joe Rogan asks questions. And that is the best thing that you could do, and trust that your listening audience is smart enough to come to their own conclusions.
Well, Alex Clark is the host of the Culture Apothecary podcast. Alex, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. One of the most significant events in the U.S. this past year was the assassination of Charlie Kirk, the leader of Turning Point USA, which is, of course, based here in the Valley. Kirk planted a lot of the ideas that would eventually grow into the MAGA movement. Many are still processing Kirk's death, including Caleb Campbell, lead pastor at Desert Springs Bible Church in North Phoenix. Campbell didn't always agree with Kirk, but he believes vilifying someone who meant so much to so many is not the way forward.
I think his legacy will be different in different communities. I think in some communities, what they see in Charlie is an outspoken, courageous young man who stood for his convictions in the public square, took a lot of heat for it, tried to be courteous and kind and thoughtful and, you know, invited dissenting opinions in the public square. And his legacy there will be, I think, a example of the virtues of free speech and individual liberty and our capacities to have public disagreement in well-reasoned ways without violence. And for those who see that in him, I honor all those values. My take on him, though, is I do see that that was an image that was curated, and he did say that he stood for a lot of those things and gave example of it. I also see, and this would be the legacy in perhaps a different community, that he leveraged derisive speech, dehumanizing behavior, fear-mongering to grow a media empire that made him millions of dollars at the expense of those whose voices are not being platformed or elevated, or those who are at risk, or those who have been pushed to the margins of the community, the communities that we're in and that he was popular in. And in that sense, I think his legacy will be as a aggressive and divisive political pundit in the lane of Rush Limbaugh. I think that there's a large shift taking place with inside the American Evangelical Church around our theology of power, whether or not power and influence is something to be leveraged to dominate over others who we disagree with, or if power is something to be, like Jesus, used in service of others in self-sacrificial ways. I mean, the central icon of Christianity is a cross, which the central figure of Christianity is a man dying for his enemies, saying, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And I think that that's the disagreement with inside the American Evangelical Church, that Charlie's movement and work showcased. Like, how you see what Charlie was doing, I think you're going to see that through a lens of your theology of power or the algorithm that you've been fed. In my tradition, there's something redemptive about everybody. And so, by no means would I put anybody in the category of wholly good or not good. An old author, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, said that the line of good and evil cuts through the center of every human heart. And so I think we're all like Charlie. Our motives are mixed. Even the good things we do oftentimes have malformed intentions, and sometimes the bad things we do had the best of intentions. And so I'm grateful for the grace of God, and I think Charlie also is a recipient of the grace of God. Charlie had a very unifying personality. He was able to bridge a lot of divides between people with inside the MAGA movement and with inside Christian nationalism as well. So, I mean, as a Christian, he was able to bring together Catholics, Pentecostals, and Reformed folks. That's very rare. I mean, he was a unifier and a galvanizer. And what I don't know is who else is able to do that. I think that a huge part of maturity is developing the muscle to carry the distance between you and me together in community. And if we're going to live in a pluralistic democracy, we have got to develop that muscle that I can exist with you and not lose my ever-loving mind when I discover that you believe different than me, that I have the fortitude to be able to carry it well and continue to approach with curiosity and not derision or suspicion. If we can develop that at some rudimentary level in Phoenix, we could change the whole country.
Caleb Campbell is lead pastor at Desert Springs Bible Church in North Phoenix. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Bill Buckmaster is something of a legend in Tucson news. The Arizona Broadcaster Hall of Famer has been on the airwaves in the Old Pueblo for decades, hosting Arizona Illustrated and eventually his own AM talk radio show. He's also worked across the Southwest in small Arizona markets, as well as in Las Vegas, with a stint in the Bay Area in the 80s. And now he's signing off for the last time tomorrow. The news has been met with an outpouring of tributes to Buckmaster's career, and my co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with him more about it and his decision to leave now.
Yeah, it's a very difficult decision, very bittersweet. You know, everything about life is timing, and making that right decision, it had to be the right time, and this was the right time. I'll be turning 78 in December, and it just had to be, it got to be the point where I want to do other things.
You've been so influential, especially in Tucson, over so many decades. We have to take a minute to talk about your career. I mean, you've done TV, you've done radio, you've done, you know, with the work with the AP, you've kind of done it all. Tell us just, you know, what stands out to you? Like, are there moments, are there interviews, are there, you know, people you've met along the way that really stand out in your mind?
Well, Muhammad Ali was one. When I was working in Las Vegas, I interviewed him and was ringside for NBC Radio News when the night when Leon Sphinx didn't knock him out. It was a decision, 15-round in February of 1978. That was an amazing experience. You know, my time in Las Vegas, as when Howard Hughes died and there was the whole uproar over did he have a will, and I covered that for NBC, that whole trial. And it just was, it's been an amazing career. I've met so many wonderful people. We've added up that I've probably done about 8,000 interviews in my career.
So, I mean, asking you what stands out among those 8,000 interviews is almost impossible to answer, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Another great one was talking with Jimmy Carter when he got off a plane in Las Vegas, and he's this governor from, you know, former governor from Georgia. And he says, I'm going to be president someday. And I'm going, you are? He's carrying his own suit, you know, in a garment bag. And he says, I'm going to be the president. You see, you watch. Okay. Yeah. It's been an amazing ride. And I've been so fortunate. And the way the business, though, has changed. I'm old school. I interview people and I let the listener or the viewer make up their own mind about that person. What's really changed is the whole thing about advocacy journalism.
Right. I wanted to ask you about your views on the role of local media in particular. I mean, you've been in Tucson and been an important voice there for a long time. I mean, watching, you know, the newspapers shrink, watching public media be attacked, watching radio change and podcasting come about and all of the technological changes we've seen. I wonder what you think about where local media in particular in our state is headed.
Well, first of all, let me say it, when I started in this state in 1988 and when I started really back in radio news in the 60s and in the 70s, every small town in America had a radio news department.
Right.
Some of my early jobs, I was the news guy. There was always a news guy or a newswoman in every small town. I worked in Sierra Vista for a while before I went up to Phoenix to do radio and TV for The Wire for AP. Then I went to Visalia, California in the San Joaquin Valley. Back in the day, we all paid our dues. We went to little towns and we worked our way up. And what I think it's terrible that so much of local news now is gone. And the news has become now so segmented. People getting it through social media, podcasting. They're not getting it in the traditional over the air anymore. It's changed so much.
Yeah, it's changed so much. Do you think there's a silver lining? Do you think you're leaving, you know, at the right time, considering the changes in this industry?
Absolutely. I think this is the right time. And where I've been on AM radio, the audiences have been shrinking. And again, that goes back to very few people now are getting their news through an AM radio station. That's very sad.
Yeah. But you have interviewed, you know, every newsmaker there has been probably in the state in the last several decades, right?
My first interview in this state, I had come over from the Bay Area where I was anchoring television, and I came to Channel 6 to take over the nightly news magazine, Arizona Illustrated.
Right.
And the first interview I had that first week in January of 1988, the governor, Evan Mecham, who, of course, was later impeached and left office. But that was my first interview. And you're right. I hosted so many of the congressional debates, the John McCain debate down here. I handled that one. I did so many of that for public broadcasting. It was really exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let me ask you lastly about your legacy and what you would like it to be and what you think it will be.
Well, I think there's been so many wonderful things that have been said and written about me. But what I really want to be remembered for is someone who was very fair and let everybody have their say. Sometimes people would criticize me, well, he throws too many softballs. But I'll tell you, by throwing those softballs, there was a lot of stuff that came out of those interviews. After the newsmaker felt relaxed, then the good stuff would usually come out, and it did on my shows.
That is Bill Buckmaster, a longtime TV and radio host here in the Southwest. Bill, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And best of luck.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Remember, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman.